So you can go ahead and turn to John chapter 20 as we continue through our series in the week that changed it all, the week where Jesus came, his last week on this earth, and where he died for us and rose again. By the way, we will be finishing the series next week, and so for those that are maybe checking out the church today, or maybe you come just every once in a while, I would encourage you to come back next week as we finish up this series when Jesus encounters Peter after he's denied him three times. But today, we're going to be focusing on the resurrection. And I want to read an article, or I want to read you the title of an article that I came across this week. And it is, South African pilot makes emergency landing after cobra slithered across his back, disappeared under seat. Would you call that a bad day, right? And so the article describes what happened. It's this small plane, one pilot and four passengers, and they are up in the air. And the pilot feels something slithering down his back or across his lower back. He looks down and he sees a cobra! Go under his seat there. And he tells the passengers, they look a little worried, but they stay calm. He then radios that he needs to do an emergency landing because apparently you can't fly with a cobra in your plane. I'm not a pilot, but that's what it looks like. So 15 minutes later, he makes an emergency landing and they all get out. But here's the thing. Once they get out, they look for the snake. And they can't find it. They can't find it. So they start searching and searching and searching. And they search for 2 days and they can't find that snake. They pull the plane apart. They can't find it. Now, after I read that story, I was feeling a little pessimistic that day. But do you know what I thought? I thought he was probably making up that snake. Maybe that pilot just wanted some attention. They couldn't find the snake, so I bet it actually didn't happen. I mean, really, what are the odds of you being up in the air there and a cobra slithers across your back? And so having said all that, I have no doubt that in a room this size that some of you are not so sure what to think, but not so much about the plane, but about Easter. Or maybe you're not even sure what to think about Jesus himself. And so, after all, you didn't see him with your own eyes. You didn't see him get crucified and then appear alive again a few days later. And so it's no wonder that some have trouble believing in the resurrection of Jesus and therefore in Jesus himself. And so that's what I want to focus on today as we talk about the resurrection. What do we do with our doubts? So are we horrible people for doubting that the resurrection story really took place? Or are we horrible people for at times struggling to put all of our faith and conviction in Jesus Christ? And as we're going to see in our passage today, many of Jesus' followers after he is alive had similar thoughts. But listen, it's in these doubts that Jesus meets his followers. And so this morning I'm going to start out in John chapter 20, and we're going to start out right at the moment when Mary discovers the empty tomb. So let's go ahead and look at verse 1. Now, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early, and while it was still dark, and saw that the tomb had been taken away, or that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So, just to give you a little context here, in John chapter 20, Jesus was crucified on Friday. He was dead that day, later in the day, and he was put in the tomb. A big stone was rolled in front of it, and we know from the other Gospels that it was sealed, and there was a guard in front of it as well. And so during this time, starting at when Jesus was arrested, his followers scatter out. They're afraid now because the person that they thought was king was no longer seemingly king anymore because he was arrested. He was overcome by the Romans and the soldiers. He was mocked by them, and then he was later that day crucified. So from their perspective, that Jesus that claimed to be God didn't seem very godlike at that time. So he died and then was taken to the tomb and laid to rest. And so from their perspective, all hope had been lost. So it's now Sunday morning, and from the other accounts of the story, we know that it wasn't just Mary Magdalene that came to the tomb. It was a number of the women that came. But John chooses to focus on just Mary in his account. And so Mary had followed Jesus for quite a while. Before meeting Jesus, she was demon-possessed, and Jesus took the demons or sent the demons out of her. And then after doing that, Mary begins following him. And so Mary had seen a lot of miracles take place over the couple of years that she followed him. Mary had seen him proclaim that he was God. Mary had seen him then after that die on the cross after he was crucified. So now let's start to think, why would Mary go to a tomb to see the person who claimed to be able to rise from the dead? And that's because Mary knew that Jesus was dead. She had seen him die with her own eyes. And so this is not just moments after the death. This is days after the death that he's been laid in the tomb. And so there is no thought in her mind at this point that he could be alive. There's no thought that she would come in there and Jesus would be there ready for her. She's not thinking that at all. She's just thinking now. She's coming to honor one of her good friends and the person that she loved and respected, and then somehow, in some way, had been crucified and killed to her astonishment. So let's look at verse 2 now. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, which is John, and the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them. So she runs to Simon Peter, who's one of Jesus' closest disciples, and what does she say to him here? Does she say, hey, the tomb is empty, he's alive? No, she doesn't say that. She says, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him. So even after seeing the empty tomb, she is not thinking resurrection now. She's thinking, hey, where'd his dead body go? So listen, after all that she saw, after all that she witnessed, after all she heard him say, the crucifixion had crushed her belief in him. So even on Easter morning now, her mind was still stuck on Good Friday. So after she says this to Peter and John, they go to the tomb and they see, yes, the stone indeed has been rolled away. Now, a little tangent here. Why would the stone be rolled away? Because in just a little bit, later in this chapter, we're going to see Jesus doesn't need doors to open to get into a place, or we'll say out of a place. And later on, we'll see Jesus just poof appears into a room. Later on, after that, poof appears into another locked room. And so Jesus didn't need that stone to roll away to get out of the tomb. So why did the stone roll away? It was so Jesus could show people if they look in to see an empty tomb. And so that stone rolled away was more for our benefit than for his. So after that, Jesus goes and meets Mary, and then they go and he tells the disciples, and then the disciples are strangely not celebrating. So let's skip ahead now to verse 19. On the evening of that day, the first day of the week, the doors being locked where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. So this is the evening of Resurrection Day. Some of his disciples had seen the empty tomb. And so surely they're rejoicing now, right? Well, no, we just saw. They're not rejoicing. They're hiding behind a locked door because they're afraid that what happened to Jesus at the hands of the Romans might happen to them as well. So they're not celebrating. And then all of a sudden, poof, Jesus appears right there in the room with the door locked. And his greeting is, "Peace be with you." That's not just the normal hello. What he's saying there is, hey, have peace. Have peace. Why? Because I'm here now. Because I got you back now. You don't need to hide anymore. You don't need to doubt anymore. And it says in verse 20, "And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord." So notice, he doesn't just say, "Peace be with you," and then they suddenly believe. He has to show him his hands. He has to show them his side where he had been pierced. And then, and only then, were they at peace. Only then do they begin celebrating. So by this point, I hope you're getting a glimpse of the uncertainty and doubt that is that plagues Jesus's followers. And I also hope you are starting to get a glimpse of Jesus's reaction to them. So if I was God, and we all know I'm not, but if I was God and I saw my followers completely forget everything I told them, everything I showed them, I would be a little bit upset at them. I'd be like, "Come on, guys. What's wrong with you?" When I tell my kids to clean the bathroom, I come up and it's not so clean. I can only be patient for so long. Come on, guys. We've shown you how to clean. And Jesus saying, "Hey, have you still lost faith in me? Have you still doubted me?" But what does Jesus do? He basically comes in and he says, "Have peace, be at peace." And then he does what is needed to assuage their doubts. And so I want you to see here that Jesus is okay with doubts. He knows that none of us are perfect. He knew that his disciples were not perfect. And because of that, it would be better for us to admit our doubt to him, to even admit our doubt to trusted friends, than to just hide it and move along through life without it. He didn't reprimand his disciples. Instead, he worked with them. And so let's go ahead now and let's skip to verse 24. In verse 24, it says, "Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came." And so Thomas wasn't at the previous hangout. He hadn't seen Jesus alive yet. And so when the other disciples tell him, "Hey, we've seen the Lord," then they likely share more about that. What do you think Thomas is thinking about? Well, if you know the story, you know he's not thinking about much there. He doesn't believe them. They tell him, "Hey, we've seen the Lord." And instead, Thomas doubts them. Thomas wasn't just wasn't believing it. Verse 25, "But when he said to them, 'Unless I see his hands, the marks of the nails, and place my fingers into the marks of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will never believe.'" So it's no wonder here that Thomas ends up with the nickname Doubting Thomas. And honestly, I think he's lucky that that's the only name he got. Because it's one thing to ask to see the resurrected Jesus. It's another thing to say, "You're not going to believe unless you touch him and touch the different holes. Not just touch his hair, but poke your fingers into the holes. Come on, Thomas. You're not just doubting Thomas, you're demanding Thomas." But then Jesus appears to him right away and helps his doubts? Well, no. For some reason, Jesus waits. The next verse, it says, 8 days later. 8 days. Have any of you ever felt like that? We say things like, Jesus, I don't understand what you're doing. Please, Lord, give me an answer. And there's silence. God, why did you let this happen to me? No response. Well, I read a quote that I think seems applicable here. The person said, God is never late and rarely early. He is always exactly right on time, his time. Emphasis, his time. So we may not know the reason why, but God doesn't just come when we demand it. He doesn't answer when we demand answers. And when we think it should be, in the end, God comes through right at the last or right at the right moment. So even when we think it should be, he comes through. Now, maybe some of you are waiting for that moment right now. Maybe your doubt is getting stronger and stronger and stronger. I want to encourage you to hold on and look to Jesus, because he will be there right at the right time. So let's go ahead and look at verse 26 now. Eight days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." So a week later, the disciples are still hiding behind locked doors. This is even after seeing Jesus. And Jesus appears through the locked doors again. Poof, he's in there. And just like he was with the other disciples, Jesus is willing to work with Thomas. Verse 27, then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, only believe." And so, did you notice that Jesus gives him the answer even before he asks for it? Jesus already knew what Thomas needed, and that's what he provides him. So then Jesus encourages Thomas, saying, "Do not disbelieve." Two negatives there, emphasizing, stop the disbelieving there. Start believing. Thomas, get away from your doubt and believe in me. And so Jesus was willing to work with Thomas, but there came a point where Jesus wants him, and he wants all of us, to stop disbelieving. To stop disbelieving and believe in him. So at some point, church, at some point you need to stop doubting, you need to stop demanding, and you need to start believing. Now, God is so patient with us. He will wait and he will wait and he will wait for you. But at some point, you have to act. At some point, Jesus worked with Thomas, but after a while, he said to him, "Thomas, it's time to start believing. It's time to push aside the doubt." Now, I want to ask you, what about you? What about you? Do you occasionally, on the news, have you ever heard of the news where someone wins the lottery but never claims it? We know there's a winner out there, but he's not taking what he's won. And that's like us when we hold on to the doubt and hold on to the doubt and hold on to the doubt and never actually believe in him. Now, after this happens, Thomas says in verse 28, "My Lord and my God." My Lord and my God. So Thomas had gone from believing Thomas to doubting Thomas and then back to believing Thomas now. But notice, he doesn't just say, Lord, I believe in you. Wow, how'd you do that? It all makes sense now. No, what he says is, my Lord and my God. So he takes that belief and immediately grasps the implications of what Jesus has done. And he immediately then calls him my Lord and my God. And church, right here is the key to understanding what it means to be a Christian. Jesus doesn't just want your belief. He wants you. The moment Thomas understood that the crucified Jesus had risen again, it became clear to him what he had to do. He had to give his entire life to him. Because being a Christian is not about just head knowledge. It's not about right belief. It's not about acting a certain way. At its core, being a Christian means having a personal relationship with God. And for Christians, the point is not if Jesus is God. The point is if Jesus is your God. So let me ask you, is Jesus personal to you? You're not saved knowing about him. You're saved when he is your God. Now, everything up until this point in the chapter has been focusing on what they have seen. We saw the stone rolled away and they could see the empty tomb. When Jesus appeared, they could see the risen Lord. They could see the nails, the holes in his side and in his hand. But in the next two or three verses, Jesus goes in a very different direction here. So he goes from what his current disciples can see to what his future followers can't see. And so this includes you and I thousands of years later. So let me read verse 29. Jesus said to him, have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Then skipping ahead to verse 31. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So here's the amazing thing. 2,000 years ago, after Jesus rose from the dead, he was thinking about you and me. He knew that we wouldn't be able to see the physical, the resurrected body. He knew that we wouldn't be able to see the empty tomb. He knew that we wouldn't be able to see his physical, the holes in his hands and in his side. So he says that we are blessed when we believe in Jesus, even though we can't physically see him. But he's not asking for blind faith. But he does realize that it will take faith. Now, there's a lot of evidence out there for the resurrection and for Jesus Christ. And in your teaching sheets, I put a number of books in there that you can look at and read that talk about the proof of the resurrection and make a case for the resurrection. But also, we see from verse 31 that John wrote the Gospel of John there so that we may believe. And that's what the rest of the Bible is for as well. It's there so that we may know God and put our faith in him and trust him and know who he is. So as you interact with the evidence about Jesus from Scripture and from science and what the other authors talk about, you will be blessed, Jesus says, if you believe in him. But even then, as doubt creeps in, I want you to know that Jesus is ready for you. So I want to encourage you to bring your doubt to him. And remember this, that we're not saved based on how well we believe in him or how little doubt we have. We are saved based on whom we believe in. So as I start to wrap this up, I want to ask two questions. First of all, have you brought your doubt to Jesus? And have you asked him for help? Maybe you've put your faith in him. Maybe years ago you did that, but something in your life has caused you to doubt him. And maybe it's something from your own actions that you intentionally pursued something that you know that he wouldn't want. And that has caused you to drift further and further away from Jesus. Or maybe it's something that happened that you don't understand. You don't understand why God would let that loved one die. You don't understand why God didn't let you have children or didn't give you children. You don't understand why God didn't let your marriage or continue or why he let it fail. And so these kinds of things, these uncertainties in God, cause us to doubt him. But whatever it is, I want to encourage you, bring your doubt to God. In Mark chapter 9, there's this father that has this demon-possessed son. And he brings this demon-possessed son who's throwing himself in fires and doing all sorts of destructive things. And he brings him to Jesus and asks him to heal the son. And Jesus says he can, but he needs to believe. And I like what the father said here. The father said, "I believe, help my unbelief." Any of you feel like that? You're there, but you need a little help getting here. The father wanted to believe. He had some belief, but then he asked God to help him take that next step. And I want to encourage you to do the same. Second question. Is Thomas's confession your confession? In other words, have you given your life to Jesus Christ? Again, I'm not asking, do you know him? Or even, do you agree with him? Instead, I'm asking, is Jesus your Lord? And is he your God? And you aren't saved until you are his and he is yours. I want to close with this story here. On August 16th, 1987, there was a Northwest flight that crashed just after takeoff coming out of Detroit. There were 155 people killed that day. There was only one survivor, and it was a four-year-old little girl named Cecilia. She was discovered under a seat with broken bones and burns on half her body. But her survival was so unexpected that when rescuers found her, they thought that she was probably in a car that got hit by the plane as it crashed down. Everyone wondered, how in the world could this little four-year-old survive the crash? And in the end, investigators concluded that most likely Cecilia's mother, sitting next to her, when she knew the flight was going down, she must have unbuckled, knelt down over Cecilia, wrapped her arms around her, and held on tight. And so she made herself a shield to keep Cecilia safe. When I read that story, I thought to myself, man, I think we would all agree that that's love. That that's love. She's now about 40 years old. And so for 36 years, she never experienced the tangible, physical love of her mother. Her mother wasn't with her on her first day of school. During the teen years, when she graduated high school, she wasn't with her on her wedding day. But would we all agree that there was likely never a day when Cecilia felt that her mother didn't love her? There was likely never a day that she questioned her mother's love. Because by one courageous act, this mother sent her daughter a message of love that will last a lifetime. And in this type of love, time or distance do not matter. Time or distance do not take that kind of love away. And I want to propose to you that what Jesus did on the cross is that type of love as well. He put himself in harm's way to secure our salvation. And by leaving heaven and coming to this earth as a man, he essentially unbuckled his seatbelt. And by going to Jerusalem and then to the garden on the last night of his life, he knelt down before you. And by suffering on the cross, he wrapped his arms around you and refused to let go. And by dying on the cross, he offered himself as a shield from eternal death. So he's not physically here anymore. But by one courageous act, he sent a message of love that should last you a lifetime. And so I want to encourage you to believe in him, to believe in his love. Because whether or not you can see him, even if you doubt him, you are truly loved. So take your doubt and bring it to him.